Welcome on a beautiful day for giving up part of your lunchtime. My name is Jennifer Gray, and today we're actually going to be talking very seriously about play, which might sound like an oxymoron, but in the early 20th century, play was serious business. This time period, actually the 1890s, saw the construction of the first playgrounds in the country, and these were driven by a certain set of social politics, which is why I'm calling the talk Bodies at Play, the Body Politic. Now, one thing I should just explain is I'm focusing on Chicago here, but the playground movement is a nationwide movement. And the reason why I'm just focusing on one city, part of it's just time, we only have 45 minutes, but Chicago was an epicenter of the playground movement. Some of the first playgrounds were established in Chicago. The Playground Association, a national playground association, was established in Chicago. And they were leaders in progressive playground design as well. So there's a good reason why I'm focusing on that city. The other is just more pragmatic. I've done a lot of my doctoral research in Chicago, so I have experience with archival materials that just let me weave a more interesting, complex story for you than if I did Boston or New York or something. So, you know, just know that much of what I say would pertain to New York playgrounds as well. So it is nationwide just for these reasons. I'm kind of limiting it to Chicago. Make sure I get my pointer here. Now, the first playground in Chicago appeared in 1895, and it was located in a vacant lot adjacent to a settlement house, Hull House, if any of you know Chicago history. By 1910, Chicago had dozens of playgrounds, and most of these were pretty complex. They had pools, they had elaborate field houses, they had athletic fields, so they were large, well-equipped playgrounds. And this rapid proliferation was part of a widespread playground movement led by reformers who were concerned about the social injustices wrought by industrial capitalism. The market revolution had produced vast inequities in wealth, appalling slums, filthy cities paralyzed by congestion, and most worrisome to reformers, an entrenched class system. And they viewed all of these overlapping factors as threatening the stability of American democratic practices. They were very concerned about this, the effect this would have on the society as a whole. And I've just given you some images here of Chicago at the turn of the century, just so you get a sense of how serious this this issue kind of was. This is a typical alley. People would just throw their garbage and even human waste in there. This is Dearborn and Randolph, which is right in the loop. If any of you have been to Chicago, which is now cleaned up with lots of plantings and flowers and whatnot, but just to give you a sense of how serious and paralyzing the congestion was. You get a mixture of these streetcar trolleys with animal traffic. I mean, there's still horses pulling buggies and the animal waste, of course, mixed in with people, so it was really quite serious. Now, playgrounds, these reformers believed, could ameliorate the cultural crisis by reducing crime, improving health, and most importantly, reconstituting socially cooperative communities. And this was because they believed that play could be instrumentalized to teach desirable habits like a respect for order, cooperation, and social unity. And just to summarize, I want to give you a quote here by one of the leading play advocates at the time named Henry Curtis. He tends to have these very polemical but succinct statements, and he summarized the democratizing function of playgrounds as this, quote, "On the playground, there is no rich or poor, high or low. You have to deliver the goods if you stay on the baseball team, even though your father is a millionaire. There is almost always complete equality between those who play together. It is the most democratic activity we know." Now, this is a bit idealistic, but just to give you a sense of how these people actually felt about play. Now, most of these playgrounds were located in the ethnic working class neighborhoods because reformers regarded labor conflict and immigration as two of the most important factors contributing to this democratic crisis. And I think today that almost sounds a bit cliche to us to cite these things, but just to give you a little context for Chicago 1900, the first recorded labor strike in Chicago was in 1847. By 1900, workers in Illinois had struck 20,783 times. So the shocking increase in the frequency of strikes was overshadowed only by their escalating violence. They became increasingly cataclysmic as well. Armed guards and militia shooting at strikers, bombs thrown in Haymarket Square killing policemen, innocent labor leaders executed by hanging, basically as an example, of course, to persuade their constituents not to challenge the prevailing socio-industrial order. So by 1900, this had really reached these proportions, the crisis proportions, and many Americans actually described this polarization between labor and capital as literally a civil war. So, of course, this is escalating in the decades after the Civil War, but they're framing it in that serious of terminology. And it's not just the laborers who are uprising in a disobedient way. Capital is also to blame, right? They're exploiting them, long hours, unfair wages, this kind of thing. So it's the conflict between the two that was most concerning. Now, intertwined with the labor problem was the so-called immigrant problem, and this is what it was termed at the time. Foreign-born individuals or children of immigrants accounted for 77% of Chicago's population in 1900. So it's an enormous amount. It's more than New York percentage-wise, partly because Chicago had less people, but percentage-wise, it's a large amount. And the majority of these at this time hailed from Southern, Central, and Eastern Europe. So they were different demographically than the previous wave of immigrants who'd been from Northern and Western Europe. And they appeared to be more different from the Anglo-Saxon, you know, Protestant majority culture. So they were even more somehow threatening to the established order. And most of them were also uneducated and unskilled workers. So this is how they get wrapped up with the labor problem, because of course they're the workers working in the factories. And these immigrants threatened democratic operations in the minds of reformers because they struggled to culturally adjust to their new environment. Most importantly, they tended to live in ethnically homogeneous ghettos, or colonies they were called at the time, actually, within the larger community. So these self-contained immigrant subcommunities were worrisome to reformers because they tended to institutionalize, meaning they set up their own, you know, ethnically segregated schools, their own medical clinics, foreign language media, this kind of thing. So they kind of were self-perpetuating within the larger community. And this type of ethnic persistence contradicted democratic social relations because immigrants, and more worrisome, their children, never assimilated under these conditions. You could just kind of keep living in this scenario. So essentially, by 1900, playgrounds emerge as this instrument for managing these new modern class relations that have to do with labor, immigration, whatever else. So that's how we're going to be looking at them today. Now, just to give you a little background on playground design, playgrounds in the early 20th century were not considered parks. Now we might almost use that interchangeably, but at this time they were not considered parks. One landscape designer in a journal, he wrote once that playgrounds are not parks, they should not be in a park, they should be nowhere part of a park. And part of the reason is their design was just totally in contradiction to the design of parks at the time. At the turn of the century, large parks derived from the 19th century pleasure ground ideal, so I'm just giving you some imagery here. They tended to be generously apportioned, they were usually located outside the city center, and they were landscaped in an informal, naturalistic manner. So you've got curving drives, man-made lakes, picturesque vistas. This is kind of typical. This is Washington Park on the south side of Chicago, so you can see this sort of beautiful, you know, bucolic, pastoral type landscape. And the image on the left hand here, I'm just giving you a sense of the existing park system in 1900 around Chicago, which was actually established in 1869. So they were leaders pretty early on in park construction. And these all still exist today. So this is Lincoln Park on the north side of Chicago. This is the South Park District, Washington and Jackson parks. And this is actually where the World's Fair was. On the west side here, we've got Humboldt Park, Central Park, which is now Garfield Park, and Douglas Park. So this ring or chain of parks already existed by 1900. The problem is that much of the city is actually in here. And so especially if you're one of the working classes, you're living closer to the factories in the city. And so these larger parks were more difficult to access because they were further away. Lincoln Park, in fact, had very little mass transportation to get to it. So you needed a private horse or a vehicle of some kind, which of course restricted its access to people with a little bit more money. So there were parks, but they just weren't located in the correct place. Now, these pleasure grounds were meant to provide spaces for unstructured activity and the passive contemplation of nature. So you went there to stroll or have a picnic or, you know, ride your bicycling in the 1890s was a huge craze. Relaxing in the fresh air of the pleasure ground was thought to offset the nervous strain of urban industrial life. And this nervous strain was an actual disease or a malady at the time, usually affecting the professional classes, which I think has to do with the fact that they can probably pay for a doctor who is then incentivized to diagnose them with something. But the disease was called neurasthenia, and the symptoms were things like irritability, insomnia, you know, this kind of, it was stress, basically. So you went to the pleasure ground to sort of alleviate this stress because you're in these natural surroundings. The pleasure ground was also thought to counteract miasmas that cause disease. And miasmas is kind of an umbrella, just sort of a general or almost vague term to describe what at this time was sort of a misunderstood idea about disease transmission. So people knew that, you know, proximity to contaminated water or human feces or anything like this, it did somehow cause disease, but the exact process was not quite, germ theory doesn't really come out until the 1880s and 1890s, and even then it's a bit misunderstood in the public. So people believed these invisible vapors somehow were emitted from these contaminated or polluted substances and you got a disease somehow. So these were called miasmas. Of course, the city, actually, as I just showed you, it's contaminated with all of these substances that then emit these miasmas. So going to the pleasure ground was a way to kind of counteract that, to breathe in the fresh air. So in short, the pleasure ground was literally an antidote to modern urban industrial life. Now, the playgrounds were kind of the opposite of this. Oh, whoops. I'm just showing you a plan, just a typical pleasure ground plan, so you can see the curving drives and what. Now, the pleasure grounds were the opposite of this in some ways. They were small, usually less than 10 acres, and they were usually located in the overcrowded slum districts. And on the right, I've just given you another map of Chicago. This was actually drawn up in 1904 by Dwight Perkins, an architect who did a lot of playground buildings, and he did a lot of buildings actually in Lincoln Park, if you know the zoo there. He did the Lion House. He did Theater on the Lake. These are his buildings. Zone 2 here is basically that park, that ring park chain that I showed you before. To this. So he's included that in Zone 2. You can actually see right here, there's Lincoln Park, there's the West Side chain, here's the South Park. So Zone 1 is the inner city, and this is where he wants to punctuate it with these small playgrounds, if you can see those little dots in Zone 1. Now, he's very ambitious, and he also envisions punctuating the far west side with parks and playgrounds and whatever else as well, planning for future population growth. Much of this would have been somewhat undeveloped at this time. And Zone 4, this black kind of line ringing Zone 3, that is now the Cook County Forest Preserves, which at this time were not built yet. But again, he proposed buying this land before it was purchased and built up and whatever else, and preserving this forest land as kind of a green belt around Chicago. So it's a pretty ambitious park system with these overlapping concentric circles. But we're going to be focusing mostly on Zone 1. So they're in the city center. Now, early playgrounds were pretty much just vacant lots dressed up with limited gym equipment, as you can see here in the Washburn Playground. Sometimes wealthy industrialists would donate undesirable land for playgrounds, usually beneath elevated railroads. This was a kind of common tactic, or nearby streetcar lines. Here is underneath the Northwestern Elevated Playground. And this was a way for these businesses to appear philanthropic. They're giving back to the community, they're donating this land, but of course they can't do much with this land from a commercial perspective. So it was, you know, was philanthropic, but also perhaps gave them something to do with otherwise unusable land. When no empty space was available, it was not uncommon for park boards to forcibly raise entire city blocks through condemnation and slum clearance procedures. So on the left, this is an empty lot that ends up being improved. This is Stanton Park before a slum clearance. You can see the urban environment is totally built up. There's houses and tenements on every block, and so these were just blocks of these would be raised to make room for the parks. So unsurprisingly, local residents frequently protested slum clearance because it destroyed their own homes and businesses. Even if for a good cause, right? So there was basically a lot of debates around the establishment of some of these early playgrounds. So I just want to make the point that these are, even though they're beneficial, they're often contested terrains where sometimes the reformers are antagonizing the same population that they're trying to uplift, right? So there's all this kind of public debate going on. And here's just Adams Park after improvement, just to give you a sense. Now, playground landscapes were formal and axial. They tended to be filled with fences, pavement, game courts, and gymnastic apparatus. Specific activities were zoned into discrete sections of the park and divided by sex. So, for example, space to play baseball and football were provided in large athletic fields, usually used by adolescents and young men. Playgrounds and sandboxes for young children occupied separate precincts, and they often included pergolas to shade the mothers who were watching the young children. Women and girls use the smaller athletic field. So here you can see this is the men's open-air gymnasium. This is the women's. It's smaller. And here's the children's wading pool and playgrounds and whatnot. Straight, well-defined walkways connected these zones and usually culminated in the symmetrically planned field house. So you've got these pathways, but everything's very axial. Everything's on a north, south, or east, west axis. This is the field house, symmetrically planned, but everything kind of is oriented towards it. So they're very formal landscapes. Now, despite the seemingly lush rows of trees indicated in plans, and you see a lot of these, for the most part, landscape features were minimal and equally formal. Trees in rows, narrow strips of grass, if any, clipped hedges, and potted plants. There was no attempt to conceal the industrial, commercial, and residential buildings surrounding the playground. So here I've just given you another. You can just see the town is right there. There's no screen of trees or anything like this to shield it out. They're very urban. Now, designers at this time believed that this was not just an aesthetic of order and control. They believed that the formal design of the playground literally dictated cooperative behavior because it instilled, quote, the idea of orderliness in the mind of the child. So this very organized, rational plan was literally thought to instill those same values in the children playing in the landscape. And just to give you another, this is another typical type landscape or playground design at the time. It has some vestiges of the pleasure ground in these curving, kind of slightly curving drives here. This is the main athletic field, which is situated at a diagonal instead of being on the north-south axis. And then these are actually on the north-south axis. This is the field house here. So it's just an alternate type design from the more rectilinear one that I just showed you. On the right-hand side, this is a different park, but it's on the same type plan. This is that diagonal ball field here. Here's the straight one here. This is the field house, which is situated at a diagonal as well. So there were kind of two basic types of designs. And there's all these variations, but these are the two major types. Now, the formal axial layout of playground landscapes suggests that certain activities were preferred over others, which was the case. Play at the playground meant organized play. Reformers distinguished very quickly between what they called directed activity and scrub play. And scrub play is just, you know, when you make up your own games and just loaf or, you know, you play, right? But this was not desirable. Quote, scrub play can never give that training either of body or conduct which organized play should give. For in order to develop the body, play must be vigorous. To train the intellect, it must be exciting. To train the social conscious, it must be socially organized. So you weren't supposed to go to the playground and just kind of mill around and do whatever you wanted. It was supposed to be organized in some way to instill these values. Now, most reformers organized playgrounds and park systems along bureaucratic lines to maximize their ability to efficiently manage these social relations. So this typically meant centralized power in the form of park boards that became increasingly bureaucratic, also playground directors that organized the specific playgrounds, specialization of activities in the playground, and also leadership by trained experts. So in other words, recreation is organized along the same lines as industry to kind of maximize its efficiency. And I should also add that this bureaucratization of play, it is a way too for these, you know, middle class and upper middle class reformers to instantiate their political power, because they are the group that has access to the education required to become a trained expert, which then becomes a requirement to be one of the leaders, right? So the bureaucratization has a way of kind of solidifying their power. And just to give you again a couple of quotes from play organizers about this idea of organizing leisure as industry, Luther Gulick, another common name in the play movement, quote, "The organization of leisure is just as important and technical a matter as the organization of the industry." So very explicit in the writings and rhetoric. Another activist claimed that the playground was, quote, "a play factory that must run on scheduled time and turn out the maximum product of happiness." So there was this idea that you could efficiently somehow produce the best play possible. Now, efficient play required that playmates be the same age, the same sex, and that the same children play together regularly. So this necessitated registration into regularly held classes, and consequently, use of the playground facilities was then run according to a strict schedule, because they had to have all these different classes going on. So just to give you an example, at Seward Park, the men's gymnasium was divided as this. Four classes of boys, categorized by age and size, interestingly, attended two regular afternoon classes after school and one game session each week. Now, the classes were things like this. So it was like dumbbell work, whatever else. The games were things like a basketball or something like that. Working men and boys attended two evening classes after they got out of the factory and one evening game each week. And the classes themselves were systematically programmed. And a typical curriculum at Seward Park consisted first of marching tactics, so kind of to get your body warmed up. But, of course, this is a vestige of military training and operations. The second thing you did were calisthenics, like wands, dumbbells, clubs. That's this kind of thing here. We're using these types of small apparatus. Then you moved on to heavy apparatus, which was more involved gymnastics work, maybe the vault or heavy weight, something like this. And then afterwards, you warmed down with just more leisurely recreation, which is often the reenacting of dramas. You would do these kind of plays as well, or maybe just play some simple games. So even in the classes, things are very, very programmed. Now, the play curriculum was typically reproduced and performed at opening ceremonies for new playgrounds. And here, the public was entertained and educated with this full program of speeches, calisthenics, gymnastic exercises, apparatus performances, all set to band music. So if there was a new playground opening in your neighborhood and you went to the ribbon-cutting ceremony, you had this performance or display, which basically replicated the types of activities that would go on in the playground. So reformers believed that these performances provided what they called an object lesson to teach the public how they should organize their own leisure time. So these were meant to be examples that you would come to the park and participate in these types of organized activities, not just go there and hang out. So it was meant to be kind of a didactic lesson at these opening ceremonies. I've just given you a couple of pictures there. Now, orchestrating the precise movements of the Reform Park required a professional play director. This was the title. He was trained in gymnastics, physiology, sociology, and child psychology, just to name a few of his requirements. So he's omniscient, right? And he's always male. This is pretty much a given at this time, and I'll talk more about gender roles in a moment. But the play director educated users in what was called rational play, which meant that he devised the playground curriculum, he channeled the activities of children into appropriate exercises and games, he enforced the rules of the game, he taught tolerance of others, and he ensured that weak children had the same opportunities as the strong. So he's meant to really calibrate these games in a way that would teach social cooperation. And actually, according to the general director of playgrounds, for Lincoln Park, which is that northern park district out of, just north of Chicago. The results obtained by this person were impressive. Quote, "With such leadership, the different elements and nationalities of the community may be so mixed that the result will be a stronger race, physically and morally, better citizens, true Americans." So the play director almost, you know, was this vanguard of shaping future democratic society. Now, the paradox of applying these scientific management principles used in the Factory to Leisure, which effectively rendered play as regimented as work, right? This was unproblematic to most reformers and play organizers. They praised the efficiency of this method, so they weren't concerned about the overstructure of leisure. However, I just want to point out that I think sometimes this is a bit of just rhetoric. I think that sheer necessity, as much as efficiency per se, partly drove the rationalization of leisure at playgrounds, literally just due to record numbers of people swarming the facilities. For example, at Seward Park, it was often reported that enormous crowds interfered with the track athletics that were planned because masses of people were just milling about the track, literally having no other space to occupy. So I've given you some images here of just how chaotic and popular these playgrounds were. One kindergartner at a different playground, she remarked that organizing group songs was her method of maintaining order over several hundred children at a time, one kindergartner. So I think sometimes this rhetoric of rationalization is more just sheer necessity. What do you do with this many people swarming the facilities? So that might also have driven as much as this idea that we're maximizing the efficiency of play. And it also points to how popular these were, right? I mean, these were welcomed interventions in the city at the time. Now, athletic fields, as you've probably noticed in some of the plans that I've shown you, they tended to dominate the landscape of the playgrounds because play organizers prioritize team games, so they become a major part of the landscape, and I've just shown you those two plans again, but you can see how much of the space is actually taken up by these athletic fields. And this was because, unlike gymnastics or apparatus work, which was militaristic and individualistic in nature, team sports were social, and so reformers argued they were democratic because they required cooperation between players rather than unfettered competition. So they have these classes where you use the apparatus and this kind of thing, and that was a good basic training to build your body and whatever else, but really the team sport was the ultimate goal for these reformers. And they believed that this team spirit inculcated during the team game was a way to combat social Darwinism and transform a competitive laissez-faire society into a socially cooperative one. And just to quote Henry Curtis again, he makes very clear this trajectory from team player to democratic citizen. Quote, "A long hit or a daring run may not be what is needed. The player must bat out in order that the man on third may run in. Many a time he must sacrifice himself to the team. This type of loyalty is the same thing we call good citizenship as applied to the city, that we call patriotism as applied to the country. The team game is undoubtedly the best training school for these civic virtues," end quote. So they really believe this would be a way to kind of instill these values into children. And keep in mind, again, most of these reformers, they operate in this kind of middle ground. They are concerned about these social injustices wrought by unregulated capitalism, and they want to fix this situation. At the same time, very few of them are socialists or communists. They're not radical. So they always want to find this middle way that you regulate these problems. You don't fundamentally restructure society. And so the team game is a tool to teach social cooperation. It sort of is a way for them to be in that kind of middle zone. Now, emerging child development theories determine which types of games children played. Some images for you. A child psychologist named Stanley Hall developed the most influential of these, and it was called recapitulation theory. And Hall argued that basically each developmental stage of the child replayed or recapitulated useful evolutionary stages of mankind. So babies were akin to savages, right? They had no social organization, which is why they just blah, blah. Young children were akin to mankind's earliest communities. Young children, you know, 2, 3, 4-year-old, they want to be social, but they also have a tendency to kind of run off and be a little anarchistic and be selfish. They don't want to share, but they do want to be with people. So they're mankind's earliest communities. They're just kind of starting to socialize. 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds, this kind of age group, they were in a nomadic phase of evolution. So they wanted to play the guns and robbers. They wanted to run off and play hide and go seek. They were more nomadic, a little bit more individualistic. Teenagers replicated the tribal organization of mankind, which is why they were so cliquish. Teenagers are so kind of loyal to these peer gangs that they form. Militantly loyal. So they represent this tribal organization. So in short, each developmental stage of each individual child, it rehearses the evolution of all mankind. So obviously this is influenced by Darwin and Herbert Spencer, these social Darwinist theories. What's important for the play movement is that the games children were supposed to play at each age mirrored the ontogenetic stage of the child, and it also mirrored cultural values held by reformers. So to give you some examples here, babies' play style, there was actually several different kinds of play styles identified by another play organizer. Babies tend to play in sandboxes and whatnot, and they just manipulate sand and mud, you know, these kind of basic forms of play, making mud pies, sand castles, hoarding sand in buckets, this type of play. This was said to recall the amphibious origins of humans, just as kind of playing in the mud, I guess. So it replicates, it recapitulates this early stage of mankind. The grasping and hoarding of toddlers was also argued to be evidence of the biological urge to acquire private property, as if hoarding the sand in your bucket is some sort of evidence of property ownership. So in this case, that's a social construct. That's not a biological urge, but it's a social construct legitimated by evolutionary theory, as if it's sort of a natural way for society to be. Young children played ring games, such as Ring Around the Rosie, which is what I'm showing you here. Whoops, I'm a little bit behind, sorry. Ring Around the Rosie, this kind of game. Red Rover, you know, we know these games. And they played these because the group singing and marching demanded that the child subordinate his personal desire for free movement to the goals of the group. You have to stay in the ring, you have to play by the game rules. So this encouraged social unity, and it recapitulated mankind's earliest communities, right? This is, in theory, a little community of children. Teenagers were the most threatening to the social order, and adolescence at this time was actually, at least among children, adolescence at this time was a new developmental category, actually identified by Stanley Hall, the one who came up with this recapitulation theory. And the trouble with it, the reason why it was a new developmental category is increasingly by 1900, there were these protracted years of education. You needed more preparation to enter adult social roles by 1900 because the modern economy had just become so much more complex. So you have to stay in school longer, this sort of thing. So the teenager is no longer a child, but he's not quite ready to assume adult social roles. So he's in this ambiguous social position, which basically precipitates this period of, you know, moral questioning, maladjustment, he's rebellious, this kind of thing. So this was seen to be a bit dangerous. In order to direct the experience of adolescence, play organizers mobilize their natural gang spirit, since they're recapitulating the tribal organization of evolution. They mobilize that natural gang spirit through team athletic competition. So teenagers tended to play like baseball, these sort of more organized sports. The team recapitulated the social clique or gang. The competition replayed gang rivalries, and the vigorous exercise mollified their potentially destructive energies. And I might also add their sexual energies. There's another leitmotif happening here about delaying sexual curiosity in boys and girls, so exercise was seen to be kind of an outlet for that too. So they're mobilizing these natural gang tendencies, but at the same time, socially accepted limitations, i.e. the rules of the game, these channel that gang spirit and compel adolescents to value the common goals of the team over his individual desires. So in this way, even the teenager learns socially cooperative behavior through playing games like baseball. Now, team participation was expected to continue into adulthood, either through adult league play or through the spectatorship of sporting events. So it's meant to kind of go on for most of your life. And I just want to say on that note, I just didn't show you more games of people playing baseball. We all know what that looks like. But if you flip through these reports from the early, you know, park reports, annual reports, whatever else, from the early 20th century, some of the most common photographs are just people running. And what's interesting is that, you know, this is sort of like some kind of race. This is a 100-yard dash. And in this case, they're not even racing on a track. This is just like a muddy playground just running, right? And interestingly, in the literature of the play movement, there's not much discussion of running. I think that it would have been seen as this individualistic type activity because you're running, even if you're on a track team, you're still running by yourself and you're competing directly with these other people. So I think it would have fit too much into this idea of laissez-faire individual competition. But I think the reason why you see so many images of it might have just been sheer practicality. You need almost no equipment to do running, right? So for these park boards that are operating under very meager budgets or very small spaces, it was just a way to do something to burn off energy of kids. So I think, again, at sometimes this idea of the team sports and whatnot can be a bit more rhetoric than it was actually practice at the time. So there's a lot of this, despite what they say, there still is a lot of this individual competition stuff kind of going on. Now, because organized games consisted of players from diverse ethnic backgrounds, reformers believed that team athletics also hastened the assimilation of immigrants. And as I mentioned before, play organizers believed that the threat posed by these self-contained immigrant subcommunities, they thought that this could be neutralized through the experience of pulling together that characterized organized sports. And just to give you a couple of quotes again, during the team experience, Americans and immigrants alike became fused together in a way that, quote, crosses the limits of race and caste and economic class. Another optimistic sociologist declared, "We're welding the people together as in a great melting pot on the playgrounds of Chicago." So this team spirit was also meant to kind of, you know, erase these cultural differences, so to speak. And here I've just brought an example, and I've left in the caption from the journal, just so you can get a sense that this was how it was publicized at the time. So the caption says, "Children of many lands forget differing nationalities when a game of three deep is on," which was another one of these kind of ring games. So the unity fostered by these games was meant to erase these cultural differences. Now, at the same time, festivals celebrating ethnic traditions and also festivals honoring national holidays were frequently held on playgrounds because reformers believed they engendered this feeling of companionship and solidarity among ethnic groups and native-born groups alike. So celebrating American anniversaries instilled immigrants with the national mythology. This is 4th of July, you know, whatever else. Ethnic performances allowed minorities to celebrate their cultural differences. So it was a space where they could express their own cultural heritage. But I just also should point out that this expression of the difference is within the proscribed limits of the festival and the delimited space of the playground. So the idea is that these cultural differences are allowed to be expressed, but they're contained in these very defined parameters. So ultimately, they're absorbed by the majority culture. So you're allowed to have your ethnic differences in the festival, but the rest of the time, you're meant to be sort of Americanizing or assimilating to the larger culture. So it can sound very, I think, patronizing and kind of top-down, but I think another way to look at it as well, the fact that these reformers were allowing and encouraging and supporting the expression of these cultural differences, they were trying to resist the widespread xenophobia that was common at this time, where people just were prejudiced against immigrants. So they were taking seriously the cultural heritage of these immigrants and trying to give them space to express that. So it's not just a patronizing top-down. In fact, I haven't talked about her that much, but Jane Addams is a key figure in the playground movement, and she's a cultural pluralist. So she was very interested in trying to respect the cultural differences, allow them to kind of coexist. At the same time, you need to teach these immigrants, these foreigners that have newly arrived, you need to give them some tools to get ahead in their new environment. So she wanted to also teach them English and this kind of stuff so they could get jobs and whatnot. So there's a whole continuum of assimilation, with some people wanting complete assimilation, that any cultural difference is absorbed into the majority culture. Other folks argued for the melting pot theory, which is where American, whatever that means, society, and these new cultures, that they melded together into a melting pot and produced a new type of person. So that's another way. And then this cultural pluralism is on the other side. So just know there's these different degrees, I guess, of acculturation. So it's not always as patronizing as it might sound. Now, ironically, playgrounds often reinforced ethnic and class divisions because the neighborhoods, and by extension their local playgrounds, were usually already socially, economically, and racially segregated. And it was, you know, not likely that you were going to travel out of your way to go to another playground simply to encourage the social assimilation. So play organizers, rather than understanding that the failure of these acculturation techniques is a function of demographics, they tended to blame the immigrants for the failure as if it's a personal responsibility. So one sociologist, for example, accused Polish people, of being, quote, utterly unused to organization, and therefore their children were impossible to engage in rational play, as if it's their fault, right? So that was kind of common. A similar logic rationalized the racism of play organizers, who usually called for completely segregated reform parks equipped with entirely separate black play directors, because, quote, colored children are very apt to form a clique by themselves and be an unassimilable element within the playground. They tend to break up the harmony of the ground and cause quarrels and frictions. So it seems in a way that immigrant children could be socialized, but black children couldn't. So there's still this rampant racism. And I've actually shown you some pictures here. These are Chicago playgrounds illustrating an integrated track competition. So you can see the African-Americans here racing alongside the other folks. Here they're cheering, right? And I brought you just the larger, these were kind of a combined image in the annual report at the time. But I brought this in so you could see, again, the quote that was published with, or the caption that was published with the original images. Quote, a study in black and white with no color drawn. Chicago pretty early on was praised for having some integrated playgrounds, as if they're on the vanguard of new race relations. They also had an integrated swimming pool. One thing I just want to point out, though, is that I think at times this is less about these progressive views of race relations and more almost integration by default, Chicago had a very small black population at this time. It was something like 2%, so it's very low. And so to spend tax money to erect these completely segregated separate facilities was almost unnecessary. There just weren't enough, not quite as much of a critical mass as a city like St. Louis or something like this, where they had a large black population. So I think sometimes this integration might have almost just been, it wasn't as pressing as the immigrant problem, where you have 77% of the population either foreign-born or a child of a foreign-born immigrant. So it just wasn't quite as much of a concern. So again, they advertise themselves as being, integrated, but I think sometimes it's just a function of the low population. So just keep in mind, nationwide, for the most part, it was completely acceptable to have segregated facilities or none. It was considered acceptable for black children to play in the street or in vacant lots or just go swimming in the fountains downtown. I mean, it was just, for the most part, it was very racist. So just kind of keep that in mind. That's brewing here as well. Last thing that this team spirit did, not only culturally assimilate the immigrant, but it was said to mitigate industrial strife in the eyes of play organizers. Reformers were sympathetic to the human damage perpetrated by modern industry, and we all know the stories of the monotonous work along assembly lines, overlong hours, physical accidents, all this exploitation. So reformers endorsed competitive team sports to counteract the regimented conditions of factory work. So after your grueling day at the factory, you get this free movement of the baseball game or something. More than just a simple recess from labor, though, many reformers argued that this feeling of solidarity fostered during organized sports after hours could be recreated inside the factory to mollify the alienation and boredom of the worker. So to read a quote from Jane Addams, quote, "It takes 39 people to make a coat in a modern tailoring establishment. Yet those same 39 people might produce a coat in a spirit of teamwork, which would make the entire process much more exhilarating than the work of the old solitary tailor. Just as playing in a baseball nine gives more pleasure to a boy than that afforded by a solitary game of handball." So the idea was that you could recreate this team spirit in the factory, which would make the work more enjoyable. Now, transfer to the factory, of course, this team spirit was also an effective weapon against labor strikes, vandalism, wage demands, and other expressions of discontent, and served in some ways to keep the workers in place under the ruse of team loyalty. So this guy, Henry Curtis, again, quote, "The point is not in making money, why else would you go to work, but in making good. In holding down the part assigned to you in the economy of the social whole, just as the boy in the school team holds down third base." So in some ways it was meant to imbue this, divided labor along the assembly line with meaning, but it also had this kind of other function of repressing conflict. So the team spirit advocated by reformers was not necessarily the solidarity of a politically empowered working class. It was more this kind of benign social cooperation. So they're trying to instill it with meaning, but I think it can be difficult at times not to see these recreational breaks as kind of a veiled means of enforcing worker compliance with the industrial order. Now, the playground also registered evolving attitudes towards gender roles. At the same time, it reinforced prevailing standards of inequality. And we've already seen the separate recreation spaces. And also specialized activities were programmed for women. And these were all meant to encourage women to use the playground. So they were meant to come in and actually use the spaces. And this is usually in the image of what was called the new woman, who possessed an athletic zeal and independent spirit in contrast to her Victorian predecessors. So I've just given you some images here. You can see the evolving fashion. As it becomes more simple, it allows for more free movement, i.e. you can play more games. This is from the 1890s, illustrating women bicycling, which was extremely popular at this time. And I think what's funny, if you read the, or I guess I'll read it for you, it's kind of small, but Ethel and Maud are having this dialogue, and Ethel says, "I hope bicycling will go out of fashion before next season. I do hate bicycling so." And then Maud says, "So do I, but one must, you know." So I think in this illustration here, it kind of tries to demonstrate that women are bicycling as if it's a fashion or a fad, but they don't really want to. But most women actually loved bike. It was very popular at the time, and they loved team sports too. So these are probably drawn by males, and they're published by males. So they're kind of trying to show the women as not really liking physical exercise, but in fact, they actually did. This is a way to kind of keep them in feminine roles. Now, the emergence of the new woman by 1900, there was numerous reasons, and I just, for time, I won't go into all of them. A lot of it has to do with a reaction against the Victorian cult of domesticity, which I'll kind of skip over for now. But for the most part, the common reason cited by play organizers, other than disease prevention and whatever else, was actually to produce stronger mothers. quote, the most important reason for caring for the girl's health and physical development is motherhood. So they were encouraged to use the Reform Park, but for this reason, not necessarily for their own benefit or for their enjoyment or something like this. It was to produce stronger mothers. Now, to achieve reproductive health, female exercise was restricted in vigor and duration, enough to strengthen her maternal capacities, but not so much that it unsexed her. So the play curriculum for young women tended to include physical exertions, not unlike those offered to boys. So they would do the marching and the calisthenics and that kind of stuff too. But once they got older, competitive games that cultivated aggressive behavior was almost uniformly discouraged by the reformers. So here's some younger girls doing things like jumping the hurdles. And I think here you can see the need for evolving fashion, because these large skirts, I mean, they're wearing special underwear. But eventually the fashion becomes these bloomers, they're called, which almost, they almost look like skirts, but they're shorts. But they are kind of flouncy and whatever else. But this, of course, was to allow them to participate in these sports. On the left-hand side, this is a good example of this new woman. The caption underneath says, freedom, energy, movement, enthusiasm, characteristics of young America, all in a game of hockey by young YW girls. So this is that new woman. And I should just add that even though reformers discouraged these competitive games, field hockey was enormously popular. And that is a competitive game. In college, basketball for women was also very popular. So again, sometimes the rhetoric of the reformers does not fit with what's actually happening on the playgrounds. These are the types of, you know, calisthenics and simple exercises. These are two girls' classes. So this is similar to the men, at least at an early stage. But for the most part, women's athletic fields and locker rooms were usually smaller than those provided to men because they weren't seen to need as much exercise. And the hours they were permitted were to use the facilities were also fewer. And here, again, is just another photo from the time period, quote, a forward movement among young mothers of tomorrow. So they're running because it's going to help them to be better mothers. Now, women's gymnastic classes were usually accompanied by music, and special attention was paid to the, quote, correction of faulty figures and the development of more graceful bearings in the girls. So here you have girls dancing as a kind of exercise, and here they're learning, you know, to be more graceful in their bearings. And I think the fact that play advocates felt compelled to disguise female exercise as dance, essentially, and that it prioritized her appearance, her graceful bearings, over health or athletic ability, spoke to these still prevailing cultural assumptions about women at the time, that they should be passive, graceful, and beautiful. In addition, reformers recommended other programming for women that emphasized activities like sewing and raffia weaving, basically to prepare girls for their future domestic duties. And some commissions, actually, in Chicago, they argued that this woman's work, it was called, should be offered for extended periods of the year, not just summers or something when they weren't in school, but all year long, so that their future domestic duties could be impressed upon the girls continuously. So there is something about domestic education still happening here at the park. And these are actually exhibits of all the raffia weaving. And here's a class actually going on. So I think in the end, this new woman certainly gains strength at the Reform Park. She certainly does, but it might not be quite enough to break her patriarchal social bonds of mother and attractive wife. One thing I should add, too, you can see this woman here directing the class. The play director was almost always a man, but he was almost always assisted by a female who was a kindergartner as well. So the playground also did offer employment outlets and opportunities for these educated, affluent women that were going to college and whatever else at the time, and they wanted they had more ambitions to have careers outside the home. So this is a good example of that. But I think that, you know, it, to some extent, she's still mothering, but at the municipal level. So her job effectively is still to take care of children and teach them things, and she still answers to a male figurehead, the play director. So she has this job, but it's still within the parameters of these more traditional gender roles. So most playgrounds, as I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, had these elaborate field houses that contained assembly halls, locker rooms, gymnasiums, offices, meeting rooms, libraries, swimming pools. So they were quite complex buildings. And here I'm actually just showing you a detail of this field house, just so you can get a sense of the types of programs that are in here. So there's a women's gymnasium, there's a men's gymnasium, there's a public library. This is the women's locker room, and this is the men's, so it's bigger, right? There's offices over here, there's a swimming pool, the locker rooms. So many different activities inside the field house. And here is where play organizers administered an intellectual training and desirable social habits, equivalent to the physical training outside. And here's just another field house. You might note they have an auditorium in this field house. Many of these spaces encourage group learning rather than individual study because reformers, kind of like the team sports, they believed that group learning taught social cooperation and compromise, which was needed in democratic communities. So neighborhood improvement groups, for example, were allowed to rent the offices free of charge to have their meetings where they would scheme about how to improve the neighborhood. All of these meetings by civic organizations and whatnot, these are all under the direction of the play director, I should add. So he monitored them, he supervised them, and you weren't allowed to have any group there. Religious and political organizations were banned in Chicago field houses at this time. They were allowed in schools, interestingly. But anyhow, the presumption here, of course, is that religious organizations might breed dissent, right, because everyone might disagree. And, of course, political organizations, more fearfully, might produce radical parties to challenge the rule of capital. So you could have these organizations, but not very contentious ones. Lecture programs were held in the auditoriums, athletic competitions in the gym that the whole neighborhood would come to. So it was meant to produce, again, kind of social organization. Citizens were intended to educate themselves in the libraries, which were usually staffed by professional librarians who directed them towards suitable reading material that would be, quote, of the highest benefit to the public service of America, to the best development of democracy. So you went into the libraries, and of course you probably just read other things too, but the librarian was there to sort of direct your education in certain ways. Social dancing accounted for 60% of the use of field houses in Chicago parks. It was very popular in the early 20th century. Temperance-minded reformers sponsored the dances free of charge, and then they sold non-alcoholic drinks at cost. And play directors chaperoned all the public dances and enforced a strict code of moral conduct, so they were very supervised. These measures were meant to lure young men and women away from commercial dance halls, which were also very popular at the time, but these are connected to the saloon often, which by extension, they're also connected to illicit vices like liquor, drugs, prostitution, this kind of thing. So by luring young people away from that environment by, you know, offering free dances, drinks at cost, it's cheaper and whatnot, they're hoping to kind of not have them be in this environment. Saloons, I should also mention, at this point, they had an important social role. They were often rallying points for machine politics. So these are places where the ward boss would, you know, have their meetings or exchange political favors. The saloon owner was often a respected person in the community. He might make a loan or help you get a job or this sort of thing. So they were these, they did play an important social and political role in the lives of these immigrants often. But of course, removing adolescents from that environment was another strategy for the reformers to undermine machine politics, because they basically weren't exposed to it, which deprived the machine of their future constituents, effectively. Now, I should say this programming at the field houses, these dances, the libraries, the lecture programs, these were all meant to empower the public, and they definitely did to some degree. I mean, playgrounds at times were the only public library in a neighborhood, or they offered the only public showers, so the only public gathering spaces. So they certainly had these benefits to them, but I think also the way in which the reformers administered these programs, there's always a trained expert supervising it. So there's the librarian, there's the play director, this kind of thing. It kind of suggests a persistent fear of the masses at the same time they're trying to help them. So the reformers are not quite ready to let the public direct themselves. They bureaucratically organize this recreation to direct the public. So they still have kind of a say in what will be happening in these programs. So they're both and, again, is what I'm saying. Now, lastly, playgrounds signaled shifting attitudes with regards to health and hygiene as well. Wellness and cleanliness were no longer personal practices by the early 20th century, kind of home remedies administered in private or not administered, as the case might be. As scientific advancement revealed many common deadly diseases to be transmissible through bacteria or germs, not inherited, health became a public responsibility. Germs at this time were characterized as being mobile, vital, and classless. And I want to read you a quote by one health commissioner who dubbed the microbe a social leveler, unimpeded by bank accounts, because it gives you an idea of how germ theory gets kind of wrapped up into these kind of class relations. Quote, "The microbe of disease is no respecter of persons. The wealthy cannot afford to sit at his well-covered table and forget the absence of food in the poor person's room. Because the absence of food means, sooner or later, that disease will break out in the room, and the microbes or their spores will in time pass the heavy curtains of the mansion and find their prey inside. This is the socialism of the microbe. This is the chain of disease, which binds all the people in a community together. end quote. So the idea that anybody could catch these germs, it was not your private fault. You could keep a clean house if you were wealthy and still get cholera. The idea that these were somehow classless frightened, obviously, affluent Americans. Now, the idea that germs were equal opportunity predators is not entirely true. Poor immigrant non-whites were more likely to contract communicable diseases, usually to factors largely outside their control. So, you know, low wages that prevented them from purchasing soap or healthy foods, poor housing that lacked running water made it pretty difficult to have clean water, or lacking light or access to fresh air. Sometimes the lack is one of education about personal hygiene and whatnot. So, you know, these groups often were more susceptible to the diseases because of these factors that are more social and economic type factors. And I, so here I've just shown you some Jacob Riis photographs of kind of tenement life. This is between two tenements, all the laundry. You can see all the children playing there, an interior of a rag picker's house. So it's difficult to maintain high standards of hygiene in these environments. And I recently found this image, which I actually didn't know before, and I just wanted to bring it in as another example here. I think it very grimly demonstrates the relationship between economic status, social economic status, and disease and death. The title is Tenement Frigidaire and Infant Mortality. Now, of course, if you lived in a tenement, you did not have a refrigerator for the most part. You usually did not even have a simple icebox. So it was pretty common to just leave your food items, including milk or meats or whatever else, just uncovered on the counter. There was really nowhere else to put them. And there was a lack of understanding that that would cause it to turn bad and whatever else. So for infants, death by dirty milk, it was caused at the time, was a leading cause of infant mortality in Chicago. And they were the first city actually in the country to introduce legislation about pasteurizing milk, that it was required. And so how to combat that? You know, these are problems of social and economic class. It's not just private cleanliness. So I just think this is a pretty grim illustration of that connection there. Now, playgrounds, since they were frequently located in these overcrowded, unsanitary districts, they became places where hygienic practices were standardized, codified, and disseminated to the public. So, for example, locker rooms and pools were often part of larger municipal bath campaigns that provided showers and toilet facilities to the impoverished, who often didn't have them in their own tenements. So, on the left-hand side here, I'm just giving you a, you know, very popular pool here. Note that it's shallow the entire way because, again, the whole point, at the beginning at least, wasn't necessarily swimming for fun. It was swimming to clean yourself. It was so popular, it was just like a fun game that, of course, the swimming as a sport part eclipsed the cleanliness part. But you know, early on, they were meant to be more of a hygiene thing. On the right-hand side, this is just a picture from the turn of the century, too, where reformers are trying to, you know, tell people that swimming is not the same thing as bathing. So if you just go swimming in the polluted river, it's not the same thing as actually cleaning yourself. So they wanted you to go to these specialized spaces that were kept at some kind of standard of cleanliness. So these are part of larger programs. Other types of programs, oh, here's another pool just to show you, Hamlin Park. This is a boys' day. Usually playgrounds only had one pool. I mean, they're expensive to construct and whatnot. So the days were split up by gender, and usually men had access to the pool more often than women did. This is ladies' day at a public bath. So you still have some of these gender inequalities written into that. Basically, public health programs were frequently held at the playgrounds, and these translated scientific knowledge on bacteriology gained in the laboratory. It translated this kind of scientific knowledge into everyday rituals of hygienic behavior that anyone could kind of follow. So, you know, here we've got these toothbrushing rituals being taught to teach people these rituals of hygienic behavior. Dairy stations would be set up that not only provided pasteurized milk, but also taught women, you know, how to boil it if they thought it was dirty, how to keep it cold and covered, which would make it last longer, you know, how to sterilize the bottle. So you had these public health campaigns basically happening in the playgrounds as well. One of the most popular of these was traveling tuberculosis exhibits, and this is because consumption was still a leading cause of death at this time. And these were very popular. They were free media events. They traveled the whole country. They typically featured, you know, posters, drawings, charts, models, everything dedicated to tuberculosis and how to prevent it. So it was meant to be an educational kind of exhibit. And one of the biggest challenges of these exhibits was to educate the public about the perils of this newly discovered microscopic world, because it was invisible. So how do you visualize this to a lay audience that might not understand the actual science behind it? Even in the 1880s, even after the tuberculosis bacteria was isolated, most Americans still believed that it was a hereditary affliction. So how to train them out of these commonplace habits like kissing and spitting and whatever else that helped to transmit it was challenging. So you had to teach them that it was communicable, contagious, and how not to pass on the contagion. So this was the goal of these campaigns. Now, to do this, these tuberculosis associations often appropriated advertising techniques from modern consumer culture. So the trademark, the slogan, visual symbols, all of this was used almost like a marketing tactic to increase public awareness. So mottos like "Don't spit," "Fresh air promotes health," "Flies carry disease." These were sort of short enough jingles that they could be put onto the side of a trolley car or whatever else so people could kind of remember them, printed on billboards and whatnot. In terms of how to graphically illustrate them, many designers employed these popular images of death and danger to convey the seriousness of communicable illnesses, because the actual bacteria itself, even if you show it enlarged as you would under a microscope, they're not very threatening looking. They just look like these amoebas or whatever. Actually, in this one, I should point out... Well, now I'm going way back. See how they give you this kind of microscopic view, but the germs themselves look like bugs or something, right? So something that would be recognizable to a lay audience that might convey something of the seriousness of these microscopic bacteria. Another common tactic was to use something like a death's head imagery, just something very blatant. So this one, for example, is from the Illinois Tuberculosis Association, and you have the skeleton mounted atop a giant fly. Can you see the skeleton there? It's a gigantic fly dropping bombs of disease, like cholera or whatever else, onto the public. And of course, killing these flies, i.e. killing disease, is, you know, imagined here to be some kind of patriotic duty. You see this machine gun sort of going up there. So these were common types of graphic design employed to teach the public. And actually, I should say on the right-hand side here, these are some of these jingles. Don't spit on the floor. Don't make dust when sweeping. And here, you know, alcoholism leads to consumption. There is a little bit of confusion, I think, still in the popular press about exactly how germ transmission works. So dust is often cited along with bacteria and germs as if dust was visible germs, which isn't quite true, right? But basically anything sort of dirty or whatever else was kind of wrapped up as a possible contagion. So you can see here there's a little bit of confusion. Don't make dust, you might get, you know, cholera or something. So there's still a little bit of ambiguity happening there. Now, germ theory was arguably democratic because it served to unite disparate socioeconomic groups into a common crusade against disease. But at the same time, these incessant warnings at these public health campaigns about ubiquitous bacteria tended to reinforce common prejudices that immigrant, poor, and black others were dirty, dangerous, and to be avoided because they were infected. And this is because they were the most common victims of these diseases because of those socioeconomic conditions. So at times, these public health campaigns kind of stigmatized these groups at the same time that they're providing much-needed education and whatever else. So it kind of worked both ways. Nonetheless, the scientific realities of germ transmission was very important. It prompted affluent Americans to realize that disease prevention was not simply a matter of individual health and cleanliness, that disease was actually inextricably linked to larger socioeconomic problems, such as unsafe tenements, unfair wages, unregulated food distribution. So these public health campaigns very quickly evolved into much broader platforms to promote a variety of reforms, like stronger tenement laws, factory inspection, food regulation, sanitation requirements, temperance. I mean, so these public health campaigns were a boon in the sense that they opened up the floodgates, essentially, for all these other types of reforms that were very much needed. Now, just to kind of conclude, oh, and I should say, I got asked this last time, the bib here says, I don't want to get sick, do not kiss me. So it's, again, another attempt to kind of train people out of these practices that might pass on germs. Now, just to kind of conclude, by the late 1920s and certainly by 1930, this idea that the playground was kind of a mechanism of social reform fell out of favor. So it's really just a few decades that this playground movement exists. Most of these reformers, you know, they seem to be, again, as I said, kind of heavy-handed, maybe a little patronizing, but most of them genuinely hope to improve the lives of these underprivileged people by providing these outlets for exercise, by providing them education, by providing them libraries and healthy amusements, and to some degree they did. I mean, these are undeniable benefits to the society as a whole, but certainly to these communities. But at the same time, the playgrounds never seriously challenged the prevailing socioeconomic order. It managed them, right? So these playgrounds are not proposing to fundamentally restructure the economy or society or class relationships. They manage those tensions and those relationships in a way that's better. They get to regulate it. So I'd like to kind of think about these early playgrounds as these kind of recalibrated civic institutions designed to regulate class relationships. And that mirrors the larger progressive movement in the United States as a whole. Again, these progressives, for the most part, are not radicals. They are not content just to let laissez-faire continue on and the social injustices. They want to regulate that and manage it. They do not want to radically overthrow society. Some do, but most don't. And so these playgrounds, along with public schools and settlement houses and other types of social centers, these are these civic institutions that are reprogrammed basically to manage these new modern social relations. So by the late 1920s, this is abandoned. And just to read you a quote by Robert Moses, our, you know, father here of park commissioner, he's appointed park commissioner in 1930. In his first annual report, he says, quote, "We make no absurd claims as to the superior importance and value of the particular service we are called on to render, making parks." So he's very clear that we're not elevating park construction to this, you know, high-minded level of social reform. Actually, the president of the American Institute of Park Executives, he said something similar. He says, park administrators should no longer view themselves as their brother's keepers. If people were not already essentially wholesome, he could hardly hope to affect their salvation through parks. So this idea is abandoned, is what I'm trying to say, by the turn of the century, and I think that, or by 1930. And I think that that abandonment should not be viewed as a failure of the playgrounds to enact these reforms. I think it's actually a byproduct of their success. Because by 1930, these initiatives instigated at the playgrounds, they're institutionalized often at the state level. So by 1930, you know, women have the voting franchise by then, right? So you have public schools at this time where attendance is mandatory and health and hygiene is expected. At this, by this time, playgrounds are a basic necessity of urban life and people view them as such. They're not a new thing anymore. You already have social welfare programs being established by the 1930s with FDR. So in many ways, these initiatives become codified at the level of legislation and state institutionalization, so you don't really need the playgrounds to function that way anymore because we have laws, we have public boards of health, and we have these other institutions to manage that. So I think that their abandonment is because they succeeded and they became institutionalized at the state level. So I'm going to leave it there, I guess, but I'm happy to take questions quickly. I mean, playgrounds obviously continued on. They vary in terms of emerging, you know, new child development theories that are always coming about. So the type of recreation, the type of equipment, and everything else just evolves over time. But I won't get into all that just for the sake of our time. But I can answer questions if any of you have any real quick. None.
In your research, did you find anyone was referring directly to Froebel's ideas of the kindergarten?
Early on, yes. Froebel has this idea that children play and whatever else, and that's coming from many different sources, not just Froebel. Like Pestalozzi is also doing this. John Dewey is a background figure here, just for time's sake, I didn't have time to bring up, but he's a social psychologist that also argued that children learn by doing is sort of a vulgar way to say it, that's overly simplified. But this idea that play is a way to teach children, it's common across many educational sources. So a lot of pedagogical shifts and reforms are also wrapped up in this that I just didn't have time to get into the details.
Little League baseball is a very central part of American culture. How does that fit in with
I was going to include, and I kind of dropped it out. Baseball was almost unequivocally the favored team sport by most of these reformers very early on. And the reasons initially are practical. The equipment's pretty simple, so you just need the bases, which could be any, you could just get pieces of wood out there or something. You just need the bat. It can be played indoors on a smaller level. And the other benefit is that it's not that physically demanding. I mean, you run, but not continuously the way you do with basketball. And so it was seen to be more accessible to large audiences, like just many different types of people. You did not have to be an athletic superstar to play baseball because it was kind of stop start, and the ball size could be adjusted so that women could play, you know, this kind of thing. So in its flexibility, I think baseball was a good practical choice. But by 1915, 1917, much of this literature actually keeps citing baseball as the best sport, and they claim too that it was characteristic of uniquely American traits, which exactly how they don't quite explain, but it was early on considered like the American sport actually. Any other questions? Football was usually discouraged, at least in Chicago, because I think it was just seen to be too dangerous. Basketball was like a good backup to baseball. Volleyball, actually, some reformers cited volleyball as even better than baseball because more people could play in a volleyball game. So you could have the courts, you could have more courts in the space of one baseball field. You could have five volleyball courts, so you could have more people playing. So it's an efficiency thing with the volleyball, I think. But And I should also state that the apparatus these people play with, the saws and the swing, there was all these debates about whether or not they should have the apparatus, how it should be produced, how it should be standardized. I mean, some people thought the swing should be abolished because it produced effects akin to drunkenness. And so this was seen to not be a moral type of play for the child. And interestingly, though, the public loved the apparatus. It was almost equally popular. They would keep count. And it was equally popular to the playing fields in terms of games. Yeah. So again, a lot of it's rhetoric. Not doesn't always work that way in practice. Any other questions? All right, well, it's a beautiful day. I will turn you loose to go play yourself. Thank you.